Now, you recall that when Elijah wanted to die, the Lord told him there were three things that had to be done. Two men were to be anointed kings, and one man to be put up to be a prophet. Elijah didn't get but one of those done. He put up Elisha to be a prophet in his place. The other two items about two kings, Ahaziah to be king of Syria and Jehu to be king of Israel, he passed on as a backlog of unfinished business to his successor, Elisha. Now, what happened to Ahab? He got killed at Ramoth Gilead, succeeded by his son, Ahaziah, who reigned less than 2 years and died, succeeded by this man's younger brother, Joram, with whom we deal today. Now, if you got your syllabus, take a little look at page 113. And we'll try to get the relativity a little bit straight here. I am sorry that some of these people have the same name as their nephews or their cousins, but that's the way life is. There's Ahab and Jezebel, and after Ahab's death, he succeeded there at the left-hand side of the page by his son Ahaziah, who died after 2 years, who was succeeded by another son of Ahab and Jezebel, Joram or Jehoram. He's the fellow that met his end in what we have today. Now, on the other side, Jehoshaphat, who almost got killed at the Battle of Ramoth Gilead, arranged for his son, Jehoram, this is not the same one, it's on the other side of the page, you notice, to marry Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. Now I wonder, do you think it's a good idea for anybody to marry the daughter of Jezebel? Yeah, okay. Is it okay for anybody to marry the daughter of Jezebel? Well, you're taking your chances. Marry anybody like that. She was the fitting image of her mother, only worse. Jezebel killed other people's children and grandchildren, and Athaliah killed her own, and we'll spend one period on this lovely lady a little bit later. But after her husband died, he was succeeded by Ahaziah, son of Athaliah and Jehoram. This fellow, therefore, on his mother's side, is a grandson of Ahab. And Jezebel. And on his father's side, he is of the line of David. And he also got killed in the affairs of today. Now, Jehu, son of Nimshi, is to be put up to be king. And Elisha has charge of getting this little item of business attended to. But you see, the trouble is there already is a king. Now, that makes the complication. It isn't just like having a country that doesn't have a king and then putting up a king, but here is a king who is in power, and you've got to put somebody else up to be king. This is, therefore, revolution. Now, God commanded it in this case. It was right to do it, but still, you couldn't expect the existing king to have a very anything other than a dim view of it. Now, you remember they were fighting over that city, Ramoth Gilead, on the east side of the Jordan. That's where Ahab got killed. 14 years have gone by, and they still haven't got it. The Syrians have it. And they have fought and refought over this, and they're still trying to get it at the time when today's material opens. And here is the army of Israel, or part of it, over there across the Jordan in the general area of this city of Ramoth Gilead. And the commander of the Israelite forces there is this man, Jehu. Now, we can trace him back a little further than that. When Jehu first sees the daylight of the pages of Scripture, he was a soldier in Ahab's army, and Ahab was still living. And Jehu was evidently a member of the elite palace guard that was attached to Ahab's branch palace of Jezreel. And furthermore, he was there when Naboth, that good and godly man, was framed and stoned to death by orders of Ahab and Jezebel so they could get his vineyard. Now, this Jehu wasn't any member of the CSS or anything like that, but this deed of killing Naboth burned itself into his memory, and he could never forget it. This was too much even for Jehu to stomach. He never forgot that. Now, years have gone by, and Jehu is over there across the Jordan near Ramoth Gilead, and it's time for him to be put up to be king, and this is up to Elisha to do it. Elisha didn't go there himself. He sent a junior prophet or an apprentice or student prophet to do it. Now, do you suppose this is because Elisha was scared to do it himself? Well, is this a dangerous assignment? Set up somebody to be king when there already is a king. Well, of course, it's dangerous. If we would hold a big mass meeting in the field house and get as many people in there as we could and have a broadcast AM and FM, you know, and suddenly have a big shout to Hubert Humphrey as president, I think the FBI might look after us, or more likely maybe the men from the mental health clinic could be in for us to see what's going on. But you see, this is treason or patriotism, depending on who you are and where you stand, depending on your point of view. Now, God commanded it, and therefore we'll say from the right point of view, this is patriotism, to put up Jehu to be king. But from the standpoint of Joram, who already is king, of course, you couldn't expect him to think of this otherwise than as treason. So this is a tricky, touchy business, and it's got to be done exactly right. And if it isn't, it'll flop. This may also explain why Elisha waited so long before he did this. It is essential that people be fed up, absolutely fed up with the previous regime, and then if somebody raises the flag of revolution, it may succeed, you see. But if they aren't fed up yet, it won't. So maybe that's why he waited, so they could have just got so absolutely disgusted with the Ahab dynasty that they couldn't stand it any longer, and then they put up Jehu to be king. Now, I think we can rule out that Elisha was scared. I had a fellow in here yesterday, and he's an army veteran, and I said, what do you think of an officer that will order a private to do something he doesn't dare do himself? I said, does that ever happen? He said, oh yes, it happened. I said, what do you think of a guy like that? Well, people in the army regard an officer like that with contempt, to order somebody else to do something he doesn't dare do himself. Now, I don't think you could be a prophet of God, a real prophet of God back in those times, and be a coward. You couldn't. A man like Elijah or Elisha had to face danger all the time and couldn't be scared, or he'd never get anything done. So we can rule that out. Elisha is a brave man, and so proved on many occasions. Therefore, there must have been some other reason. Now, I would suggest this. The Bible doesn't say what the reason was, but see what you think of it. Elisha is a public figure and well-known. Many thousands of people know his face and know him when they see him. If he starts going across the Jordan River and further east there, this will immediately raise suspicions. What's the prophet going over there for? It is possible that some people had talked about Jehu as a possible candidate for the throne, and if they see the prophet going over there, this will raise suspicions and maybe let the secret out too soon, and everything will fail. So he sends a young prophet who is absolutely unknown. This fellow is anonymous. They don't know him from Adam and Eve. And he can go without attracting the slightest attention, so he is given the job. Now, Elisha coaches this fellow. Here's this bottle of olive oil. You take this with you. And when you get there where the army is, you find Jehu, the son of Nimshi. He'll be the ranking officer there in command of the troops. And get him off by himself someplace. And pour this oil on his head and say to him, thus saith the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel, and your orders are to exterminate the family of Ahab, etc., etc. And then when you've got that done, you run and don't stay there. So this young prophet goes. He finds the place. It isn't in the city of Ramoth Gilead, but in the area, not far from there. They're not fighting, but it's shaping up for a battle. And he finds Jehu attending a meeting. Now, I think we can picture a scene here. There was a house there. This is mentioned, the house with the door to it. Group of officers, perhaps 10 or dozen, sitting in a circle, maybe under a tree. And they're having a business meeting, maybe discussing their plans for the battle or something. And the prophet comes up, and he does not know Jehu by faith, so he has a problem. Which of these men is it anyhow? He doesn't know which one would be Jehu. So he walks up to this circle of men and says, "I have a message to you, O captain." And Jehu speaks up and says, "To which of us do you have a message?" This proves he was the chairman of the meeting. He answered, you see. And therefore, he's the one that the prophet has to deal with. "To you, O captain." He seconds him. Jehu gets up and follows his prophet. They go in the house, shut the door. The prophet pours the oil on his head and says, "Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel, and you are to do such and such." And then the prophet goes out and runs. Jehu comes out a minute or two later, perhaps looking a little bit shaken. It's kind of sudden, you know. And these officers sitting there said, "Jehu, what did this mad fellow say to you?" Now, mad there doesn't mean angry. It means this crazy nut, this psychoceramic. Any psychology majors here know what a psychoceramic is? Well, this is not really a psychological term. A crackpot. What did this crackpot, this crazy fanatic, say to you? Man takes the man in the house and talks and comes out and runs. And Jehu tries to evade answering that question. "Well, man, you saw the guy. You know what kind of a fellow he'd be and what he'd be likely to say. Jehu, it's false. Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth." So he has to tell them. If he doesn't, they'll guess it. And he might as well tell them straight. "All right, men. You want to know what he said? He poured oil on my head and said, 'Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel,' etc." Now, these men are absolutely on the spot. They've got to decide right away which side they're on. And they can't take all day to do it either. Right away. Are they going to say, "Jehu, very sorry, sir, but we swore an oath of loyalty to Joram, the king back there in Jezreel, and it's our sad duty to clap these handcuffs on you and put this chain on you and take you back to Joram, who will hold a trial and judge you for treason?" Or will they say, "It's about time we had a new king. Hurrah for Jehu, our new king." Now I wonder, which did they do? About it. What did they do? Were they in favor of him or against? In favor of him. Unanimously, apparently. Everybody. Please note, this speaks volumes about the state of public opinion in the country. When the flag of revolt is raised up on the flagpole, they're unanimously in favor of it. They are absolutely fed up with the Ahab dynasty and have had more than enough of it. And so they want Jehu to be king. Now, this was a one-story Palestine farmhouse with a flat roof, and outside there would be a flight of steps going up to the roof, and halfway up this there would be a landing, about 4 feet square maybe, and then some more steps going up to the top. And they put Jehu on this landing and spread their outer garments on the lower steps for a impromptu red carpet treatment. And they shout, "Hurrah for our new king, long live King Jehu, Jehu is king." Now, this is fine, they're all for it. But you see, there's a problem about it. There's already a king on the other side of the Jordan River, and they can't just proclaim Jehu king there at near Ramoth-Gilead and let it go at that. If they're going to put up Jehu to be king, they also got to do something about the king that's already king. So Jehu, who was certainly no Sunday school boy, was, however, a very active person in getting things done. He said, "All right, men, thanks a lot. Glad you feel that way. Let's get to Jezreel before the news of this day gets there by any kind of grapevine." So they start out with chariots. Now they got to go across part of Transjordan. These chariots are like springy two-wheeled affairs. Of course, nowhere near as fast as a car, but pretty fast for a horse-drawn vehicle. As long as the terrain is anything like smooth and level, they got to go across part of Transjordan, down into the Jordan Valley, not the lower end of it, though. This is the northern end, the middle to northern, which is not so deep as the southern end, up to the western side, and across several more miles of the plain of Jezreel till they get to the city of Jezreel. So they start out with chariots, and they're going as fast as they can. This will be a trip of the whole day, or maybe possibly even more, but it's a long and hard ride. Now, meanwhile, at Jezreel, here is King Joram, son of Ahab, second son of Ahab, and Jezebel. He has been wounded in battle at Ramoth-Gilead while fighting the Syrians. Now, people that got wounded in battle usually died of it. They had no antibiotics, you know, no penicillin, acromycin, tetracycline, or any of those things. They didn't even have mercurochrome. And when you've got battle wounds, they would usually get infected and people would die of it after a while. But if they did survive, it would be a very long, slow process, heal very slowly. And Joram has been wounded and is slowly getting over those battle wounds, but he's not bedfast. He can walk around, but he isn't fit either. And meanwhile, his nephew, his sister's son, Ahaziah, son of Athaliah, grandson of Jezebel and Ahab, king of Judah in Jerusalem, has come up there to the northern kingdom on a get-well visit to his uncle who is getting over his battle wound. Now, if this fellow Ahaziah had stayed where he belonged, he probably would have lived longer. But he went up there to see his uncle and was there when doomsday struck, and it struck him. Now, two kings, therefore, Joram and Ahaziah, both at Jezreel. At the edge of the city, there's a watchtower. This is like the one where Ahaziah stashed the silver. Not the same one, though. A watchtower. And now this is time of war. So there's a guard up on top of that, a lookout, to scan the horizon. And he will watch in all directions, especially toward the east, toward the Jordan Valley, where the other side of it, where the fighting was going to be. See if the enemy's approaching. And anything unusual on the horizon, he should report that down to the king or to one of the king's officers. And he would be up there for hours and then be relieved by another one. And they have an around-the-clock watch of the horizon from the top of that tower. A watchman up there reports down to the king at the bottom, there's a cloud of dust on the eastern horizon. A little later, he reports there are horsemen and chariots coming this way from the east. Still later, he reports they're coming nearer. And it looks to me, sir, king, that the lead chariot must be driven by Jehu, the son of Nimshi, because he is driving furiously. Now, Jehu had a reputation as a furious chariot driver. Everything about Jehu is furious. And a lot of people have quoted this, to drive like Jehu, who haven't the faintest idea who Jehu was or what he did. This is where this saying comes from. Drive like Jehu. You'd go try going 110 on the turnpike and you're driving like Jehu. Now, the driving of the lead chariot must be the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, who driveth furiously. The king says, send a rider out to ask his peace. So a rider gallops out on horseback. The guard on the... this rider gets up with him and says, his peace. What peace? Get behind me. And the guard on the watchtower reports down, the rider met up with the men, but is not coming back ahead of them. You see, a man on horseback could go faster than a man in the chariot, because the horse doesn't have to pull a chariot. But this one isn't coming back ahead of them. He's standing behind them. The king sends out a second one, and it happens again. And then Joram says, all right, get two chariots ready. One for me and one for Ahaziah. Isn't it nice of him to take care of his nephew this way and get him killed? One for me and one for Ahaziah, and we'll go out and meet him face to face. By this time, Jehu and his band of men are maybe a mile or two from the city gates of Jezreel, just near. And two chariots go out, and perhaps some others following them, but one with Joram in, the king, and one with Ahaziah, his nephew, the visiting king. They bring their horses to a stop, and Jehu and his men stop theirs, and they stand there. This is a confrontation, definitely. Is it peace, Jehu? What peace? As long as the witchcrafts of your mother Jezebel are all over the place. And he put an arrow through his heart. Just before he died, Joram cried out, Ahaziah, treachery! And Jehu says, get him too. Why do you want to get him? Grandson of Ahab and Jezebel. He's on the list. They had a merry chase to get him. Chased him apparently for miles, but they got him. So here's two kings dead. The revolution is less than one day old, and two kings dead. This is quick action for you. Now, who's next on the list for death? Guess who? Jezebel, who has outlived Ahab 14 years. Now, Jehu, remember, had been a member of the palace guard, and he knew exactly what was where in this city. So he and his men go down the street to the royal palace, and unlike other buildings, this was two, maybe three stories high. And Jezebel is in an upper story. Maybe she had a premonition. I won't accuse Jezebel of ever having a guilty conscience, but a premonition of what was coming, and began to think, well, this is it. She hears the thundering hoofs of the horses on the cobblestones coming down the street and getting nearer. What would you do if you knew you had 5 minutes left to live? Would you try to pray? Or would you try to run away and hide someplace? Jezebel didn't do either one. Here, this woman suddenly realizing this is it. I am face to face with life's greatest showdown, namely death. The first thing she did was to pretty up her face with rouge. Archaeologists digging near there found a compact, a bronze compact in the shape of a clamshell, and when they opened it, it still had a little trace of red, of rouge inside. And one of them said, maybe that was Jezebel. Well, maybe it wasn't. In fact, in all probability, it wasn't, although, of course, it might have been. It may have been like Jezebel's, though. Well, she prettied her face with rouge. Do you suppose when she married Ahab years and years before, she was candidate for May Queen or something like that? Well, I don't know if she was or not. I kind of think that I can hardly believe that Jezebel had any real female beauty. Anybody as hard-hearted as this must have had a hard face, too. But, you know, you can buy it and paint it on. So she prettied her face, and then she fixed her hairdo. Said she tired her head. This means she fixed her hair and put on a nice new hair ribbon. Here's this wicked woman, face to face with death, and she thinks about her personal appearance. Something. And by this time, Jehu and his men are just down below there in the street. And she pokes her head out the window and hurls out a taunting remark. Did Zimri have peace that slew his master? Now, Zimri is the guy that was king for 7 days. He assassinated and got the kingship and was assassinated after a week. The Catholic Bible translates this verse slightly differently, but in both cases, she is comparing Jehu to Zimri. Jehu, you're a second Zimri. You're playing a dangerous game. That one got assassinated. Now you watch out. And Zimri has peace that slew his master. Now Jehu won't even talk to her. He looks up at that window and says, who's on my side? Who? And three or four of the palace servants poke their heads out the window and he says, throw her down! Now you know, the people that were closest to Jezebel, that were with her every day and lived with her there and waited on her, there wasn't one of them that tried to help her or protect her. This again speaks volumes. These people have been waiting for years for somebody to say throw her down. And now when somebody says it, you know, they pick Jezebel up hand and foot and toss her out the window. This is Jezebel. She scrapes the stone masonry on the way down, and that draws a little blood, and she falls flat in the roadway. And Jehu, who certainly must have had a strong stomach, he backs his chariot off and then goes forward, crunch, you know, and back and forwards about six times just to make sure that she's really dead. And finally decides, yes, she's really dead. So then, now would you feel like eating dinner if she just got through doing a job like that? Well, I'm sure you wouldn't. I sure hope you wouldn't. Didn't bother Jehu at all. He goes in the palace and starts to order the servants around and throw his weight around and show everybody he's king. Calls the butler and head waiter, I want dinner served for me and my staff right away. The work, soup to nuts. Yes, sir. So a meal is served, a banquet for Jehu and his staff. And they eat. Imagine it, after that day's work. And toward the end of this meal, Jehu says, oh, I just remembered something. That woman lying dead out there in the street is a king's daughter. She'll have to have a royal state funeral. You two men go out and make the arrangements. So he sends two of the ghosts out. King's daughter, daughter of Esbaal, king of Sidon, you recall. Now they come back in about 5 minutes. Sir, there won't be any royal state funeral because there aren't any remains. All we could find, sir, was one little piece of her skull and part of the palms of her hands and part of the soles of her feet. So the dogs have eaten all the rest up. It is said that these fierce wild dogs that roam around Oriental cities will not eat the palms of a person's hands because they taste bitter. I have read this statement. Now, there won't be any funeral. This fulfilled Elijah's prophecy of years before at the entrance to Naboth's vineyard. Near the place where Naboth was stoned, the dogs are going to eat Jezebel. Now, everything that we have had about Jehu up to this point, while extremely gruesome, was commanded by God. What comes next, I do not think was all commanded by God, and certainly not the way Jehu did it. He gathered the worshippers of Baal together by deceit. He lied to them and said he was holding a meeting to worship Baal and then massacred them in cold blood. He did not give them a chance to swear off the worship of Baal, and he lied to them and got them there by a trick. This cannot be justified. And then Ahab's 70 sons. Now, how could Ahab have 70 sons? You suppose Ahab had, Miss Gary, you suppose Ahab had more than one wife? Well, you suppose Jezebel would have allowed it. Now, I can tell you, if Jezebel had been an American, she wouldn't have allowed Ahab to have more than one wife. You know, American women don't like to be married to a half or a third or a quarter of a husband. But Jezebel wasn't an American. She came from Phoenicia. And very likely, she not only allowed this, but also insisted on it. If Ahab had 25 or 30 concubines, Jezebel would be the boss of all these women and could order them around and boss them every day from morning till night and sort of build up her ego doing it, you know. So it may be that these 70 sons, you see, we know of two sons, Ahaziah and Joram. These are the legitimate sons of Ahab and Jezebel, to whom he was really married. Now, the rest of these may be the sons of Ahab and a bunch of concubines around the place, or it is possible that they were grandsons and cousins and so forth that could possibly be considered heirs to the throne. However, they're all young people, and because Ahab is dead, they're wards under the guardianship of the city council of Jezreel. Now, 70 of them. Jehu sends a letter to the city council of Jezreel. Just remember, this is the same council that had Naboth stoned to death. Years later, maybe the members aren't all the same, but probably some of them were. And the letter is, when you get this letter, pick out the one of your late master's sons that you consider has the greatest potential, put him up to be king, and we'll see whether he'll be king or I'll be king. And they replied, "Gee, Hugh, we don't intend to do anything of the kind. Nobody is going to cross your wishes or oppose you. You tell us what you want done, and we'll do it." So he sends a second message. "All right, I want the heads of Ahab's 70 sons about this time tomorrow in two baskets. This is Jesus for you." Now I will dramatize the rest of the scene slightly. We've got time for it. The next day, one of the palace servants comes to Jehu and says, "Sir, King, your majesty, there's an express shipment arriving. Sir, it's sort of gruesome. It looks to me as two large baskets full of human heads." "Yes, I've been expecting those. Have them piled in two piles at the entrance to the ground." So here they are, piled at the entrance to the palace grounds, 35 and 35. And there they lie all night. And the next morning, Jehu goes out for a little exercise, a walk in the fresh air, you know. And he comes to this place. Horrors! The atrocities! The bloodletting! What awful times we live in! Horrors! I admit I conspired against my master Joram and slew him, but who is guilty of this massacre? And he had ordered it, of course, but he tries to put on like he's horrified and shocked at this. "You suppose you fooled anybody?" "Well, just a minute, and I'll give you a modern tale. I don't think he fooled anybody. I think everybody sees through Jesus perfectly well. He is given a reward for killing the descendants of Ahab. His descendants will reign for four more generations. You count Jehu as five, and you just count his descendants as four more. On the other hand, the way that Jehu went about this was offensive to God, and you cannot help feeling, as you read it, Jehu enjoyed killing people. What would you think if there was somebody under sentence of death in the state penitentiary and had been reprieved a time or two, and the warden is eating his breakfast, you know, and reading his paper and so forth, and drinking his coffee, and the telephone rings, and it's the governor of the state who says, no more reprieves, that man is to be electrocuted at 12 noon today. And the warden would say, oh, goody, goody, another electrocution. Now, the people of Pennsylvania wouldn't stand for that. And, of course, rightly they wouldn't. It might be the warden's duty to carry out the law, but that he would enjoy doing it would be absolutely intolerable. And it's one thing to do what God commanded, and it's another thing to think that killing people is fun. And this is what Jehu evidently thought. Now, here's the modern parallel. In World War II, General Rommel, which the bell rings told us a gift or two, was one, Erwin Rommel, one of the greatest generals on the German side. He gave the British and Americans a merry chase back and forth across North Africa for years. Later was back in Germany, and there was a plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler. A bomb, a high explosive bomb, was put in a briefcase, and this was put under a table in a room where a conference was to be held, and Hitler was to be there. And the plotters put this where they thought Hitler was going to sit, under the table. Somehow they miscalculated, and the people at this meeting, several people, did not sit in the order that they had expected. The bomb went off and blew the place up. I think it even killed a couple of people and hurt several others, but didn't hurt Hitler. And after this, there was a manhunt to find out who was responsible for this. And General Rommel was suspected of being involved in this plot. Now, I don't think it was ever proved that he was. But he was suspected of this. And two officers of the elite guard, SS Schutzstaffel, in solid black uniforms, came to Rommel's very fine house. He was a very high officer. Clicked their heels and saluted and said, "Sir, the Fuhrer gives you your choice of two things. You can stand trial for high treason and be publicly disgraced and put to death. Or, fish something out of his pocket, you can swallow this cyanide ampule, and
it will be reported in the news media that you died of a heart attack, and your wife and children will be taken care of. You will be given a state funeral with all honors, and your wife and children will be taken care of with a generous government pension as long as they live. Sir, the prayer gives you 15 minutes to make up your mind. Rommel said, "Men, I don't need 15 minutes. I'll give you my answer right now. Swallow cyanide." Handed over to him, they clicked, saluted, and went out. You see, because of his very high rank, he was allowed to commit suicide instead of being executed. They clicked their heels and went out. Rommel had to put that in his pocket. He went upstairs and kissed his wife. Said, "I have to go out on some business. It was a car. I may be back late. Don't wait dinner for me." He got went downstairs, went out in his car, and drove several miles, fished this thing out of his pocket and put it in his mouth and crunched that glass with his thin wet, you know, with his teeth. And in seconds, he slumped over dead, and the car veered into the ditch and was somewhat wrecked up. And it was announced that Rommel had died of a heart attack, and this resulted in the wreck of his car. And Hitler sent a letter of sympathy to Madame Rommel. He couldn't have sent it through the mail. It was too wet with crocodile tears to go through the post office. It must have been delivered by a messenger, but simply dripping with sympathy. To Madame Rommel, Hitler said he was crushed and heartbroken at the death of this dear friend and this great man who had done so much for his country. And the whole nation of Germany would never get over the loss of Marshal General Erwin Rommel. And everybody was heartbroken over this. And Madame Rommel got this letter, and she knew there wasn't one word in that from the beginning to the end that was sincere. It was phony. But she couldn't say anything for fear the same thing might happen to her, happen to her husband. I don't think Adolf Hitler fooled anybody either. Not with that letter anyhow. And so Jesus didn't fool anybody. Now Jesus was a man who did some things that God commanded, and it had to be done. You know, no nice person could have done it. God had to call a guy that was the toughest of the tough to do this grim and gruesome job, but it had to be done. On the other hand, the way Jesus did this and the way he felt about it was highly offensive to God, and takes delight in violent death is terrible. And therefore he is also censured as well as given a reward.